You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Well, another edition of MLB.com Extras, the National League Central edition. And this week we learn how the Brewers, too talented not to be normalizing, Pirates continue their surge as the Cardinals remain one of the most boring teams in baseball, winning seemingly night after night. The Cincinnati Reds still searching for themselves, and Carrie Muscat. One week she's dodging traffic in Chicago. This week it's tractors in Milwaukee. That and much more on this week's edition, MLB.com Extras, National League Central Edition. And Jen, you know, I almost don't know where to go with this anymore. The Cardinals just keep winning. And they, I don't know, I want to say they make it look easy, but they kind of do. And there doesn't seem to be anything at this point that can phase them. They've become almost, if you will, boring in a way. 38-19, what are we left to talk about with this team?
It is kind of like Groundhog Day every time we get on the phone each week, Dave. Yeah, I mean, it's just really continued to be kind of same old for this team. I mean, we've talked a lot about the starting pitching. That continues to be very good. They had a stretch over this last week, seven straight games of seven inning or longer starts from their rotation. So that was certainly an impressive run. The bullpen continues to be lights out. You know, Trevor Rosenthal is good as any closer right now in the league, and his supporting cast is very good. And, you know, the offense has shown up when needed. I think what we saw over the weekend in Los Angeles, we saw a lot of late inning kind of offense from this group. We had two games where they trailed going into the eighth inning, put together an eighth inning rally and won a game. I thought an interesting number to come out of that. Last year, you look back at a team that won 90 games. Only three times did they win games when they trailed after seven innings. This year's team, they've already won five such games. So, you know, the offense has been timely. The pitching's been really good. And, yeah, it's, I guess boring is the right word. But certainly I know fans in St. Louis are okay with boring right now.
Yeah, no, if this is the face of boring, they'll take it. But, I was almost hoping that something would come out of Kershaw drilling Matt Carpenter, that Carpenter would fire back. And all he does is come back and say, no, I don't think he was throwing at me. Even in those instances, we can't create a little news, a little controversy.
No, very, very drama-free club here that Mike Matheny has. You know, it was interesting. You just think back to some of the battles that Kershaw and Carpenter have had, most notably the last two postseasons. You look at the one in 2013, a 13-pitch at-bat that Carpenter eventually ends with a double that starts the game-winning rally that sends the Cardinals to the World Series. And then again last year in Game 1 of the Division Series, he battled Kershaw deep in the count again and then had a bases-clearing double that capped an improbable seventh-inning comeback. So, you know, they do have some history. They get that. Went eight pitches before Kershaw hit Carpenter the other night. But, yeah, I mean, Carpenter downplayed any intent. And, you know, and with Kershaw, it didn't really seem necessary or kind of the time that if there was intent behind it that you would have seen something like that. And certainly the fact that the Cardinals did not retaliate either later that game or the next day would suggest that they didn't feel there was any malice on that part. But, yeah, I mean, they can't even give us a storyline. I mean, we potentially had one, and Carpenter let that die down real fast.
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, you're the point now where you're kind of rooting for Twitter to give you something. But, look, it's June, and it's early June, which means it's time for the draft. Now, it'll happen later tonight, so we're out in front of this just a little bit. But are you a draft gal? Do you get into the all the machinations, the mysterious nature of who a team might pick, or are you sick and tired of hearing about best player available?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I covered the Pittsburgh Pirates, during the years that I was in Pittsburgh, always picked very high. I think my 5 years there, they picked second or fourth each year. So, during those years, I think I was probably into the draft a little bit more because you had a clearer idea of who they were going to go for, or, you know, kind of a small pool of talent that they were looking at. You know, with the Cardinals, it's very different. You know, you look at their first pick coming at 23rd, it's really hard to figure out, you know, exactly what they're looking for. I mean, we look at recent years with this organization, they have gone very heavy on college pitching. You look at Michael Wacha in 2012, Marco Gonzalez in 2013, and kids, the guys that were drafted and then made their major league debuts about a year later. This year's draft isn't so full of college pitching, so I think it's going to be interesting to see if the Cardinals take a little bit different path this year or if they still do find a college pitcher somewhere. I think for me, that's a little bit of the intrigue. And then not to mention that they have a new scouting director this year in Chris Correa, and so We'll see how he puts his fingerprints on the whole deal.
Well, they've been so adept at just filling gaps and, you know, improving the team in the margins, with whether it be through the draft or acquisitions. You know, you don't see a whole lot of splashy behavior on the part of the Cardinals organization, generally speaking, right? I mean, they just go about business sort of methodically, almost like this team has been this year. For you, you're covering the draft on a night like tonight, these next couple of days, what do you do? You're just waiting to hear the name, and then you got to scramble and go track this kid down. What's the job like for you?
Yeah, you know, the first night is fairly simple. I mean, when you look at kind of the, you know, the first 75 picks or so, I mean, these are high-end talented kids. There's usually a lot of information, and, you know, and the Cardinals, at least for us, are kind enough to usually set up conference calls. Days two and three are a challenge in terms of covering the draft, because oftentimes, especially when you're looking at high school players who are picked, you can do all the research you want to try to find out what you can about them, but sometimes there's very little available online. You rely on a lot of the hometown newspapers, the stories that have been written. It's kind of sketchy as to whether or not there's going to be stats online. So a lot of phone calls, a lot of calling college coaches, high school coaches, a lot of flipping through kind of the online phone books to try to find phone numbers for kids. And, you know, really the kind of the fun that I have in the draft is finding the unique stories. And they're there. I mean, this is, you know, the organization's going to pick 42 players over the next 3 days, and there's going to be some very special and different stories among those players. So, it's my job to try to find those beyond just, you know, writing about the obvious top talents that they pick and kind of shed some light on maybe some guys that would otherwise get very little notoriety. And, you know, I think the other wrinkle of the draft this year that's going to be very interesting is Mike Matheny has a son who's going to be drafted very high. There's been a lot of debate as to whether or not the Cardinals will be interested in picking Tate Matheny, and whether or not Tate Matheny even wants to be picked by the Cardinals and join an organization where he would be probably most known for being Mike Matheny's son. So I know it's a big day for the Matheny family, and then the possibility, again, of Tate getting picked very high, and then also the Matheny's high school senior, Luke, also potentially being a draft pick this year.
What does Mike Matheny say about it? Does he want the Cardinals to pick him?
Yeah, I mean, Mike has kind of waffled a little bit back and forth on the topic. What he's talked about kind of the perils of having a child in the organization where he's the coach. You know, personally for him, he said he'd love to have Tate Matheny in the organization to be able to keep track of him. He'd be down there at spring training. It'd be much easier for he and his wife. That being said, he's also talked to those like a Chris Duncan or a Cody McKay, guys who played in an organization where their father coached, and, you know, in talking to those guys, they, you know, find out that it's not always the easiest, and have some of them tell them if they could do it over, they would like to have been in a different organization where they didn't have their father, again, kind of dominating the conversation. So Mike Matheny has told the Cardinals that they are free to pick Tate if that's the best player on their board at any given time, and he's let Tate know that it's, you know, really his decision to communicate with the scouts what his wishes are. And it seems to be over the last couple months that it's gone from Tate preferring not to be drafted by the Cardinals to him now actually being open to it. So, certainly the Matheny family doesn't want this to be a situation where the Cardinals, you know, kind of pull any favors and draft their son. But again, if he's the best player on the board when they have a pick, it does seem like that the Matheny family is willing to let the Cardinals choose Tate.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. It will something we'll keep an eye on. I guess one thing also to ask is Lance Lynn. You know, he left Sunday's start after five innings, and I had a little tightness in his forearm. What are we hearing about Lance Lynn?
Yeah, Lance Lynn downplayed it, as you would expect Lance Lynn to do. You know, if he has two arms and two legs, he's going to be out there pitching. So that doesn't surprise me. But, you know, as he described it, had some forearm tightness that developed kind of in the first couple innings and then stayed with him through five innings. And, you know, he attributed some of it to the long innings that he had. I believe he threw 27 pitches in the first inning and then 29 pitches in the third inning. So just it kind of exacerbated the issue. But he doesn't seem to think it's going to be anything that's going to keep him from making his next start in 5 days. And actually mentioned that this is something that he's felt earlier this year at times, and obviously it hasn't stopped him from pitching just yet. So good news, too, from the Cardinals medical staff is apparently the location of the tightness didn't really lead to much concern. So right now it seems to just be a minor issue, but certainly was a factor last night in the fact that he only made it through five innings, which for the first time this year didn't eclipse that 100-pitch mark, which usually is pretty much a gimme for Lance.
Yeah, okay. All right, so nothing there. Well, listen, if If something comes out of the draft, we'll have that for next week. If nothing comes out of the draft, then I'm counting on you to really stir it up in that clubhouse and create some controversy, something for us to talk about next week, Jen.
I'll do what I can. I mean, we've got to find some drama here because we have to keep our listeners happy. And, you know, right now, again, this is just a team that keeps winning, but they are bound at some point to hit some adversity, and we'll be here to talk about it when they do.
Carrie, it's Monday, and it's Monday, June 8th, which means that the draft is later tonight. I'm just kind of curious, you know, sometimes depending on teams' statuses, you know, we'll see folks focusing on the draft for months. And, you know, for other teams, it just is part of the summer patterns. Cubs have been such a delight on the field this year. Has there been a whole lot of buzz about the draft, or is this just something now we're going to go ahead and do tonight?
Well, I don't think there's been as much buzz as there was the last 3 years, only because the Cubs are now picking ninth as opposed to picking in the top four, which they were doing because of their poor records. The Cubs front office, I know Theo Epstein has been out himself doing a lot of he likes to go and watch the players themselves. They've got a huge scouting department, and they've been, from what I understand, they were holed up together in Chicago, you know, going over their notes and, you know, making sure they talk to everyone from the little league coaches to the elementary school teachers, just to make sure they do good background checks on all the players. They're going to, you know, they give us the standard cliche answer. They're looking for the best player available.
Ooh.
And the trend, you know, what the way the team is performing on the field really doesn't affect who they're going to draft. I mean, teams don't draft for need. They draft in terms of who's available. So the Cubs right now, in the past 3 years with Theo at the helm, they're taking position players, and then they stock up on pitchers. I think I went back, and of their 33 top picks over the last 3 years, 28 of them were pitchers. So it just shows you that's, yes, they're loading up on pitchers, but they prefer to take whatever that best player was, and their first-round pick was more a position player. So they picked up, you know, Chris Bryant and last year with Kyle Schwarber. So it's so far those two kids have all three kids that they've picked with Al Moore, they've all done very well.
Yeah, and go back to 2011, Javier Baez, you know, another one.
And
of course,
well, that was before Theo came in.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
But you know, Javi, the latest news on Javi, unfortunately, Javi really was doing well this year. He's had just a really difficult year for a young man. You know, he lost his sister, 21-year-old sister, who had been dealing with spina bifida. He lost her in April, came back to the AAA team, was getting back on track. He'd been moved over to third base to get a little experience there. He was batting .314, and I guess on Sunday slid into second base and suffered a fracture of one of his fingers. And so now he's going to be out minimum of 4 weeks, 4 to 8 weeks, which is really, it's just really bad timing because he was really swinging the bat well, getting on base, coming up with multiple homer games. And from talking to people who had seen him and talked to him, he was in a really good frame of mind. So that's a sad setback, but knowing Javi, he'll bounce back from this okay.
Yeah, what a frustrating year, though, like you're saying,
yeah.
Whether it be, you know, the off-the-field issues he's dealing with family, or, you know, it's getting crowded in Chicago, too, with such great talent at his position. And we even see Addison Russell this last week playing a little bit of shortstop as well. So,
right.
I mean,
yeah,
it's just...
Addison Russell, any time Addison Russell gets a chance, although I have to admit, Addison Russell at second base has been pretty good. Sorry, there's a tractor behind me. Anytime Addison Russell at second base has been good, but watching Addison Russell at shortstop is even better because you can tell it's just his natural position and the way he's just how fluid he is over there and how comfortable he is. But I do like seeing Addison at short every once in a while. I guess he gave Starlin Castro a rare day off. I'm sure Joe Maddon had to do some convincing because Castro had told us that he wanted to play every single game. So the fact that he did not play one game and actually gave it up for a day is quite a feat.
Yeah, and probably more pressure, too, with guys like Russell breathing down his neck. I mean, Castro's
I think Castro doesn't – we've talked about that, especially when Baez was up last year, and it really didn't seem to faze Starlin too much. You know, his thinking was, you know, I do my job and you know, Javi will play wherever Javi's going to play, and now Russell will play wherever Russell's going to play.
Yeah, well, I think that takes a lot of strength to keep that mentality. Hey, speaking of the mental games, Carrie, what's going on in this bullpen? You know, it seems like everybody's always very leery about messing around with closers, and now the Cubs, all of a sudden, 3 wins in that series in Washington, and they have 3 closers.
Yeah, Hector Rendon, I think, is going through a phase where he's just lost a little bit of confidence in some of his pitches. And what I like seeing in Sunday's game was the TV cameras caught Miguel Montero and Rendon talking in the dugout for an extended amount of time, just really one-on-one, pretty intense. And you could tell it was Montero doing most of the talking, which anybody who knows Montero figures that's the way it's going to be. But Rendon, I think, is just he's trying to get a better command, get his confidence back. And they used him in the 8th inning in the last game of the series against the Nationals, which I think was probably a good way to ease him in. He had a good inning, and let's build from there. The nice thing is they have a guy like Jason Mott, who has been coming back from reconstructive surgery on his elbow, and you see him come out, and he's throwing 97, 98, and pick up a save and look like the old Jason Mott. So that's actually very encouraging for the Cubs to think that they've got that kind of backup. And Pedro Strop, I've always thought, could maybe do the job, but he seems to like being the setup. Some pitchers kind of like being the setup guy better, and I think Strop is one of those guys.
Yeah, well, whatever's working right now has certainly been effective for the Cubs, and that's good news. They get a nice day off on Monday and then to Detroit for a couple. And then they'll come home, and for the first time in what seems like forever, they're going to have fans in the right field bleachers. It's like the third iteration of Wrigley Field this year.
It does seem like it's been forever, too. It'll be nice to have the bleachers full. It'll be nice to have it'll be nice to see people out there as opposed to the workers. As much as the workers, nice guys, I'm sure, but it will be very pleasant to have it back to semi-normal, you know, with everybody out there. So the right field bleachers should open for the Cubs' next homestand, which is against the Reds, I believe, and I'm sure the outfielders will appreciate that, the fact that they'll, you know, have folks out there and they'll have just kind of things back to normal.
Yeah, it'll create, you know, add that energy to that ballpark, too, which is such a special place. Well, in the interim, Carrie, tonight, the big draft, I just want you to have your eyes wide and be on the lookout for that best athlete available. I think that's the guy.
Yes,
I keep hearing little stories
about players, so I'm really kind of curious to see which direction they go. They do seem to like the college kids, but I know that because they're – and the other thing that they've talked about is that, you know, that they hope they never pick this high again, which is kind of an interesting approach. You know, it's like we don't want to pick in the top 10 anymore. We want to be picking, you know, later in the round. So that's kind of – the Cubs, I'm sure, want to make the most of this, and we'll see what happens.
That's the right mentality, though. I love that. I love it. All right, Carrie. Yeah. As always, this week, thanks for dodging the tractors and giving us the insight. It's always fun. We'll do it again next week.
All right. Very good. Thanks, Dave.
Tom, it's Monday. It's Monday afternoon as you and I sit down to have this conversation. And it's June 8th, big day in the on the baseball calendar. But at the same time, one of those dates that we won't really know a whole lot about for another 3, 4, sometimes 5 years from now. Are you a big draft guy? Do you get into this stuff? Are you, you know, you're fascinated by the process? Where do you come down on the major league draft?
Well, I'm not so much into it as, like you mentioned, there's no immediate effect. It's not like basketball or football. But, you know, that timeline that you mentioned could be as short as 2 years. I mean, we saw it with Gerry Cole. 2 weeks, I mean, 2 years and 1 week after he was drafted, he made his debut. And obviously he hasn't slowed down, hasn't disappointed, and it just keeps getting better. But that's a unique situation. And, you know, pitchers, you'll see them making an occasional immediate impact. Position players, not so much. And, of course, it depends whether, you know, you drafted out of high school or college. Somebody like Gerrit Cole drafted out of a college with a good baseball program, UCLA. There's a lot of other prime college programs where, you know, basically some scouting directors will equate a good college program with a double A ball, which means you're only two steps away from the majors when you get drafted. So I think one of the most fascinating things from the Pirates' perspective, from Pittsburgh's perspective, is that there was an awful lot of interest in the draft when the team was going through its drought without a winning season. It was almost like fans were looking at the draft as a lifeline, and it kind of kept interest in the Pirates even when the team, the major league team, wasn't as attractive. Now, obviously, it's an interesting dynamic because the team's doing very well and continues to draft well. They have a couple of pretty high picks coming up in the first round, as well as a complimentary pick for, you know, having lost Russell Martin in the draft. So it's, you know, they're kind of getting the best of both worlds right now in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of those things you see, and I've made this reference before, like, you know, in Washington with the Nationals when they were, you know, on the cusp of the Strasburg and Bryce Harper drafts. The Houston Astros in recent years has had that annual first pick of the draft. And so when the team's struggling, you know, it can be a source of optimism, you know, look at what the future may hold for this team. And the Pirates have seen plenty of that over the years. It's neat. And I think it's so cool that that's no longer the story. And it probably, is there much conversation about the draft these days in Pittsburgh? Or is it all about what the starting pitching has been doing?
Not nearly as much as we saw in past years. I mean, you know, we made a point about Cole, but you should not forget the fact that on any given day, the team on the field is full of number one draft picks. You know, Pedro Alvarez, Kutch, Neil Walker. So, I mean, This it's not just Houston, which is the most recent example of making a quick impact, but, you know, with the Pirates brought their guys along a little bit more patiently. But on any given day, especially when Cole's pitching, half the team on the field is former number one draft picks.
Yeah, when Gerrit Cole is pitching, these days, everybody stops to watch. I mean, he really has been something. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, his ascension to the big leagues was quicker than most, even in the context of college pitchers. I mean, his was pretty fast, and now 30 wins already in his young career, just 53 starts in. That is just so remarkable. Can you put that into some context for folks who kind of wonder what that really means to get 30 wins in your first 53 starts?
Well, I imagine the best context is to point out that nobody with the Pirates has done that in 90 years, let alone a left-hander, won 30 wins in his first 50 starts in 1924, 1925, but hasn't been done since. And in this day and age, where a lot of people say that wins for starters aren't as indicative of what they're doing, and maybe it's a bit of a devalued stat because of the role of bullpens, for somebody to still be able to put up that kind of pace is remarkable. And it's a reflection of the fact that, you know, Garrett usually pitches deep in games, and is on in situations to pick up a win, you know, or a loss. Equally remarkable, out of those 53 starts, he's only had 9 and no decisions. If you take a look at the most pitchers' track record these days, the percentage of no decisions is a lot higher than that.
Yeah, right, which is evidence of the fact that this guy is in there to win or lose the game. I mean, he's competing until that critical moment.
Well, and it's not so much that he's in there long, but, you know, he, you know what, Clint Hurdle likes to say that the magic number in offense is 4. If you score 4 runs, most teams will win the majority of their games. The magic number with Cole is 3, when the Pirates have scored at least 3 runs for him, he's 27-2.
That is amazing. And I don't know if this one is just a statistical anomaly or if it says something of real value about the starting pitching staff. But you've been updating us on this, wins by the starters, and they have won.
Right.
Is it now 15 consecutive games that have been?
No, 16. Coles was 16.
Okay, I mean, what does that say? I almost don't know what to make of that.
Well, it says that the lineup's putting up runs in time to put the pitchers in position to win. They protect the lead, and it says an awful lot about the work that the bullpen's doing because none of those are complete games. None of those 16 wins were complete games. So, the setup relievers are in place. Caminero and Hughes and Mark Melanson. For all the grief he was getting early in the season, he had a couple sour outings. I mean, he's been impeccable. Overall, he's 17 out of 18 in saves, and they're like 16 in a row.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I guess those are all really good points because I guess it underscores why we don't really care quite as much anymore about wins and losses for pitchers. But your point is a really good one. To win 16 straight from the starting staff, that means the offense is clicking. They're putting up runs and putting you in a position to win. But it also means that bullpen has been very steady. At the very least, they haven't coughed up any of those leads. So, the spotlight shines on the starters because they're the ones that have won those 16 straight. But yet it really is the work of everybody else that makes that whole thing possible.
Well, absolutely. Considering that they average a little bit over 6.5 innings per start, you can see what a large share the relief corps has in protecting all those leads. Because if they didn't protect the leads, the Bucks may still wind up winning the game, but the starter doesn't get the decision.
Yeah. Well, it's also, again, we've talked about this a little bit recently, but this team, right now, second place in the division, and granted the Cardinals still have a sizable advantage of 6.5 games, at least as you and I are talking. But boy, this team, they're playing as well as anybody, and it seems like they just get incrementally better, more consistent day by day. Finding club.
Absolutely. And, as far as the dynamic with the Cardinals is concerned, they played them a couple of times early in the season. They got swept in St. Louis, 3 very tough losses, extra innings, walk-off wins for the Cardinals. But when they meet again, and they don't meet again until, I believe, the last series prior to the All-Star break, when they meet again, St. Louis obviously is going to be taking a look at a total different Pittsburgh team. If they can just hang tight until then, close, obviously they're not able to gain any ground on St. Louis because the Cards keep winning as well. But if they hang tight, they'll be able to take matters into their own hands. And they'll feel a lot better about seeing, St. Louis red across the field than the last time they met.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm sure they'd be looking forward to seeing them right now. Winners of 13 of their last 16 games, the surging Pirates, making things very interesting in the Central Division. Tom Singer, always fun, man. We look forward to doing it again next week.
I look forward to it, Dave.
Adam, here is it's a Monday afternoon, June 8th. And this is a big day on the baseball calendar. Every year, that first day of the amateur draft. Some teams, they're just so focused on what's going on the field and the excitement of maybe being in a race, that kind of thing. The draft sort of comes and goes. And then there are teams that are struggling so badly that, hey, let's talk about the draft. Is it that way in Milwaukee? I mean, are people, have they turned their attention away from what's happening on the field, and are they all abuzz and speculating about who they may or may not get with the, 15th pick of the draft?
Yeah, I don't know if the baseball draft is ever going to be like that, because you're talking about guys, even the most advanced college player is, 3 years away? Chris Bryant, the Ryan Braun. So I'm not sure that we're ever going to get to a point where this draft has the same level of buzz as, say, around these parts when it's Packers, the time for the Packers to draft, and you're talking about picking a player who's going to be on the field and on the first game of the season and play, you know, all year. It's just different in baseball. But that said, I mean, a team like the Brewers, they have to build with the draft because while they've pushed payroll to a level it's never been before, it's you're still talking about needing to fill a lot of your club with homegrown talent. So the draft is a big deal for Milwaukee. And I think it's a good week, you know, a good example of that this week here because on Tuesday in Pittsburgh, Brewers fans will get their first look at Taylor Youngman, their first one of two first-round picks a couple of years ago, their top pick that year. And, you know, a guy who's going to come up and get his chance to make his big league debut and perhaps make an impact on trying to salvage something to the season. So the draft is a big deal, I think, for teams like Milwaukee more than others. But still, this is an exercise that requires a whole lot of patience.
Yeah, well, no doubt. I mean, I guess you can go back to some Washington Nationals years where there was a lot of excitement over guys like Harper and Strasburg, and then the Astros for those number of years where they every year had the first pick, and so it was kind of like an annual celebration. Oh, who will they pick? But you're right. In most cases, it is just another part of a very long process. Are you a draft guy? Do you get into following some of the names and getting to know some of the landscape when it comes time for the amateur draft, or are you one that's just let's just have
it? I should say yes here, Dave, and say I know all the players and I have dossiers on each of them and I'm ready to roll when the Brewers make their pick today. But you know, I'll be honest, I sort of jump in on this day and learn about the guy as best you can. You know, day two and three, there's always great stories that come out as you do your research. But even when you have a very top pick, the Brewers were fifth overall when they picked Ryan Braun. And even that year, there was such a long list of players that they were connected to. It's hard to do work like you do in other sports where you can narrow it down and kind of see what direction a team is going to go in. In baseball, it is just so wide open. And look, we're sitting here on Monday afternoon, and we don't know 100% who the Arizona Diamondbacks are going to take with the first overall pick. So I'm not sure how we're supposed to do much research for when you get down to 15. But look, it's a little morbid if you're a Brewers fan. But next year might be a year where they have, they're at the top of the draft or near it and are looking at one of the top, you know, the big name guys that everybody's talking about going in. I imagine then there would be a lot more buzz. And really, if you look at it, the history of this draft and where the really great players come from, it's very often at the absolute top of the draft. And if it's not a guy at the very top of the draft, the second most likely thing is a guy who dropped for signability reasons. Now, that term is sort of being removed from the draft conversation by the new rules. But if you look back a number of years, it was often signability guys that would fall, say, to the end of the first round. It's really hard otherwise to find top talent, even in the middle to the late first round. It's amazing in this game just how difficult it is to draft and predict what's going to happen with some of these top players.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And there's so much more information these days. It's harder to sneak guys in and you know, as teams were able to do back in the good old days. But so the draft later on tonight, and not to be too distracted from what the Brewers are doing, though shut out the other day, they've played better baseball lately. I think they've won, four of the last seven games. And I think we talked several weeks ago, just stabilizing, right? Just getting back to playing reasonable, representative baseball where you've got a fighting chance every day to go out there and maybe win a game. And I feel like maybe that's starting to happen. Maybe they're starting to kind of level things out a little bit. The bats are still a little quiet on occasion, but they seem a lot more competitive.
Yeah, you know, Craig Counsell used the word last week, getting things normalized, talking about what Mike Fiers was able to do for them in St. Louis, coming in and after that long 17-inning game they played. And he helped get them a little normalized, and it was since then that the streak that you're talking about. And you're right, the first step is just play better baseball, because this is not a team made up of kids and no names, and, you know, it's not a bad team. Again, we've talked about this many times, Dave. You look up and down the roster, and there are established players that went into the season with some hope of being a good team. And it's still those same players now that they've gotten some guys like Jonathan Lucroy off the disabled list. They're kind of back to that team that they thought they'd have. So So yeah, it would be nice to play more representative baseball because, for one thing, it's better to watch. For the other thing, it would put them in a much better position to make some decisions as we get closer to July 31. There's been a lot of talk around here about whether the Brewers would start to look at trading players. Well, it's really hard to trade players when they're A, on the DL, or B, you know, playing poorly. And for most of their guys who were in that conversation, they fell into one of those camps. So if you get these guys back playing again and playing at a more normal level, I think it puts Doug Melvin and his staff in a much better position as July 31st gets closer to look at making some deals.
Yeah, a point worth making for sure. You mentioned Taylor Youngman. He'll be making his debut on Tuesday against the Pirates. And he's I remember he's a kind of a power arm in college, right, at Texas, I want to say. But his numbers haven't been very good in the minor leagues. What's the conversation around Taylor Youngman right now?
Well, you know, sinker ball guy. And you're right, he was maybe more of a power arm in college. He's evolved into more of a pitcher in the pro ranks. And, yeah, his numbers, especially this year, aren't great. But, again, the Brewers now are at Colorado Springs, and they're learning what they knew going in, that it's going to be really difficult to read numbers at that place. Offensive numbers are totally inflated. It's an incredibly difficult place to pitch. You know, when they made their first call-up for a pitcher this year, they went down to Double-A, and I was told that, hey, that's not going to be completely out of the ordinary anymore because it's just Colorado Springs is a weird place, and maybe they'll hold guys away from Colorado Springs in certain instances. They'll keep them at Double-A a bit longer until they need them and make them jump all the way to the big leagues. But Youngman was a guy doing his best at the Triple-A level, inconsistent this season, but look, it's his opportunity now. And they had a kid come up, Tyler Cravey, who had similar kind of, you know, here and there numbers at the AAA level, but came up and pitched a gem for them. Unfortunately, the Brewers needed that roster spot badly when Ryan Braun went out for a treatment on his hand and Cravey had to go back down. But this is a big opportunity for Taylor Youngman to kind of stake a foothold in this rotation. And this is a, you know, a team of opportunity. Where they're at in the standings, it's slowly but surely we've seen players come in, younger players. This roster has skewed young in the last 2 weeks, and Youngman is the latest example of it. So a chance for him to earn himself another start or two beyond Tuesday.
Well, and what a great place to make that first start, too, at Pittsburgh. Perhaps the polar opposite of pitching on the surface of the moon there in Colorado Springs. So maybe that'll give him a little boost as well. It'd be interesting to watch. And also be interesting to see what the Brewers do in the draft later on tonight. Adam, always great stuff, and we'll look forward to doing it again next week.
All right, see you, Dave.
And Mark, we are bumping right up on the draft. It's it's a Monday afternoon as you and I chat here. The Reds 7 games under .500. And, you know, week to week, we get the sense that they might still be in it for a wild card type thing, or they might be ready to fold the tent. In any case, it seems like the type of year where there's maybe a little more interest than usual in the draft, even though, you know, you're always talking years out. But the Reds might have their eye on the same guy everybody else has their eye on, which is that best available player, from what I understand.
That's been their MO the last several years. They certainly, as I'm sure other people have told you, for other teams, you can't draft for the need of what's going on with the club right now. Obviously, the team would love to add some pitching or add a bat based on what's going on with the club right now, but you just can't do that. You have to go with what's best available, what fits the needs years from now, perhaps. So it's we'll see what happens. There is a kid locally here that a lot of Cincinnati residents will be looking to see if he can fall down to the Reds, Andrew Benintendi. But he's probably more of a top 10 pick, and the Reds pick 11. So some stars have to align for that to happen.
Yeah. And while we kind of joke about that best available player or top athletic guy available, the Reds have at least tipped their hand a little bit in that they would lean a little toward pitching. Am I right?
They have in some years, but a couple of years ago they took an outfielder in the first round in in Irvin, and they do like power pitchers, and they have not necessarily made it a conscious effort to get those kind of guys, but they've, like last year they got Nick Howard, who was more of a reliever, and they've made him into a starter. A couple years ago they got, in a later of the first round, they got, of course, Michael Lorenzen, who was a college closer and an outfielder, and they saw him as a starting pitcher, and of course he's now in the major leagues. So they do have a kind of a liking of these guys that can throw really hard, power pitchers, 95 to 98 miles an hour, and they identify them as future starters sometimes. And if that doesn't work out, they could always go to the bullpen. And that's been kind of an MO they've had not only just drafting, but also some of their, you know, out internationally, which is something they did with Raisel Iglesias as well.
Lord knows they couldn't get somebody to the bullpen fast enough these days, and the draft isn't going to necessarily help that, but they are making some moves. I see Jumbo Diaz has been optioned back to AAA Louisville. It just seems like that bullpen continues to be a bit of an Achilles heel.
It really has been. Right now, especially last week, we talked, and they were on the heels of a sweep at Washington, and they were going to Philadelphia with such high hopes. You know, the Phillies were struggling, and really, looking back, they should have swept the Phillies, and they should have taken 2 out of 3 from the Padres. But in a lot of those games, it was the bullpen not coming through. They got 2 walk-offs in Philadelphia against them. They had a game lost against San Diego on Saturday, and 2 of those leads were 4-run leads, and they couldn't hold it. So it wasn't just Jumbo Diaz who was struggling. He was one of the guys struggling the most. But, you know, Tony Cingrani, after some nice outings, has kind of slipped back. And he, of course, gave up the game tying grand slam on Saturday and kind of got chewed out on the mound a little bit for not showing the best conviction on the next batter when he walked Will Middlebrook. So it's been tough for the bullpen, and they're still working their way through it.
Yeah, and you know, bullpen losses, if you will, those are the toughest to endure. I mean, it's just there's a mentality or there's a psychological effect that comes when guys blow leads. And nobody's immune to the hurt or the frustration. And certainly Brian Price has shown he's not immune to it. It looked like he just sort of had enough on Saturday.
He was very irritated. They had a 6-1 lead and then a 7-3 lead in the seventh. And he didn't like the fact that before they even got to the bullpen, I think he felt that there was some letting up off the gas a little bit, that they didn't take advantage of some of the opportunities they had in the middle innings to pack on some more runs and make it more of a sure thing. And then he really lost it with Cingrani. He gave up the grand slam, and that part, he says he can live with that. That was a good at-bat. That was a long at-bat, and it just Alonso had a great hit. He did a good job. He did what he was supposed to do. But what happened next was the walk to Will Middlebrook, and he didn't feel like Cingrani was really into it there, and he stormed out. Cingrani tried to offer him the ball, which he didn't want. He thought that Cingrani was kind of looking over his shoulder to get taken out of the game, and he didn't like that. And then, of course, when he went back in after the third out, he let the entire bench have it because he really thought that they just weren't fired up as much as they needed to be, and he wanted them to be fully committed to trying to win that game again. And he lost, you know, he got angry, which is what happens sometimes. And now they move on. They won Sunday, and now they have the Phillies again and Cole Hamels today.
It just seems like it's been such an up and down year for this team. I mean, we're not that far into it, but man, it's like, literally last week, you and I were talking about, hey, if they could continue to string together some good series, it's a team that could, you know, maybe consider themselves in a wild card hunt and, you know, play for that the rest of the way. You know, now this week, you know, Brian Price, you know, with his, I guess, exhibition of disappointment on Saturday, and the team not playing as well, and now some roster moves and the continuing struggles with the bullpen, and you start to wonder, geez, 7 games under, are we talking about the trade deadline next and who they may move? It just seems like it pivots so quickly back and forth this year with this team.
Yeah, that's true. It's been that kind of year. They really haven't had a winning streak of more than 4 games, which was, one of them was last week, and one was the first week of the season, and They haven't had that real big extended spark that could bring the mood up and bring just kind of the expectation to win every game. And that's been frustrating for them. They haven't been able to get over the hump. But it's still early enough that you don't have to necessarily worry about the trade deadline yet. Although I did bring it up to a couple guys, Joey Votto and Jay Bruce, and there's certainly an awareness that it is lingering out there. And if certain things don't happen between now and, you know, early July, they may have to look at moving some guys, and that's certainly aware. It's the business of baseball. But they also know they can't put added pressure on themselves to win games solely to keep Johnny Cueto or Mike Leake from getting traded.
Yeah, yeah. Devin Mesoraco is going to start a rehab assignment now, and which is good news. I mean, that's definitely good news. But from what I'm reading, it sounds like he's not going to do a lot of catching, right? I mean, he's going to be playing in the outfield?
He's not going to do any catching. He's not going to catch the rest of the year at all. But what he is going to do is try to play left field. And it's something that they feel that if he can do that and contribute, that they would like to get some value out of the season. Like you said, that with the wild card being an option, even though things aren't going well right now, they want to have every chance they can to try to go after that. And they feel like if he's in the lineup every day and he can play a satisfactory enough left field, that they would do that. But there's still some hurdles to cross. He's going to do about a minimum of 3 or 4 games to see how that goes with AAA Louisville. Obviously, if there's no injury, then he can maybe either get some more games down there or come up to the major league and start contributing. They feel pretty convinced that the pain that he felt in his hip was never repeated doing anything other than catching. Like when he would squat, that's when he would have the pain. But they've not been able to repeat that pain or soreness from running, from hitting, from doing anything else. And so far in his early outfield work with the coaches, with Billy Hatcher and Jim Riggleman, there hasn't been any trouble. So they're going to keep moving forward with this. And now there's even the possibility, after a second opinion, he may not even need the surgery. So that would be good news for him. It still remains to be seen. But if he does need the surgery, they think they can do it after the season and then come into 2016 ready to catch again.
Yeah, interesting. That would be quite the journey back. And like you say, I mean, if they can salvage a couple of months and get used out of that bat and playing in left field, especially now with Marlon Byrd hurt, at least for the moment, that'd be a little bit of a boost. Well, Mark, I know it's the big night of the draft. You got a lot to cover, a lot to keep up with. We always appreciate the time, and we'll look forward to some good news next week.
All right, thanks.
Well, we've done it again. One full week of baseball stuffed into a podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. MLB.com Extras, the National League Central Edition.